Welcome back to another episode of the Shift Drink Podcast. I'm Ed Rudisell, and not surprisingly to anybody that's been listening to the show lately, we are diving back into Japanese beverages. But the main difference being today, we are talking sake with Brandon Don in Brooklyn, who's the master brewer of Brooklyn Kura. Several different expressions available, and one of the few breweries in the United States making sake of this quality. And so welcome to the show, Brandon.
Oh, thanks, Ed. Thanks so much for having me.
I'd say that because if you haven't been listening to the show, this is probably about 6 months of Japanese episodes. I visited Japan for the first time in August, and yeah, just met an amazing industry full of people making yeah. You know, shochu, sake, bartenders, expats. It's been fantastic. So circling back around to the United States a little bit without losing my ties to Japanese beverages.
Nice. I'm glad you had me on as a fermenter and not a distiller.
Yes. Did I say distiller? Oh my gosh.
No. Oh, okay. No, you didn't.
All day I've been like, I know I'm going to do that. I know I'm going to call him a distiller at some point. Yeah, absolutely.
No, but I've seen your past guests, and you're pretty distillery heavy.
We are pretty well. I'm a big rum geek, so yeah. But you know, I absolutely love sake. We haven't really dove into it hardcore in this show, and I know that it's a lot more. It's a topic that's much bigger than a 45-minute episode. And so I just kind of wanted to get a little bit of your background before we jump into it, because I'm really fascinated by the whole idea of an American sake brewery where traditionally we don't have that heritage. So, I mean, how what did you do before kind of diving into this sake brewing world?
Yeah, so my background, I'm a research scientist. I'm an organic medicinal chemist. Graduated from the University of Oregon with a biochemistry degree, and worked at a lot of pharma companies and some universities, and just developed drugs, which is a very
the hard sciences are, you know, like the math and physics and chemistry. There's not a lot of wiggle room. It's very kind of strict thinking, 2 + 2 = 4, and that's it. There's no nuance. So, you know, coming home and making beer or making wine or cooking, those are like my ways to relax. And you can kind of look at a recipe, but then you can do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. So I've always kind of had that in me, and I think that's kind of my path to doing this. There's still a lot of science in sake making.
Sure. Yeah, you have an ideal background for it as well, particularly when we start talking koji, which we'll get into here in a moment. But I mean, I think that's kind of an ideal background to be coming at it and understand the science, but like you just alluded to, being able to kind of stretch your wings a little bit, play around, see what comes of it. So how did you get pulled into sake then?
Well, I was a drinker and sure, a sake drinker prior to that. So that's always a good way to get into it. And then I met my business partner, Brian Polin, in Japan, because we had a friend in common who married an Indian woman who grew up in Japan. So we had a multi-part wedding starting in Connecticut and then ending up in Tokyo. So that was both Brian and I's first trip to Japan, and the newlywed couple was gracious enough to kind of take us around Japan a little bit before they headed off for the real honeymoon. And during that process, we walked into a couple like very traditional sake breweries, and you know, I spent a lot of time in Portland, Oregon, on the West Coast. I've been to plenty of like wineries and breweries, but a sake brewery, like I drank sake, enjoyed sake, but didn't really have like the visual of a sake brewery or the taste and smell of it being made. So that had a big impact on both of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime you can walk into a place and see it being done, I mean, that's where my love of a lot of distilled spirits, as you'd said at the top of the show, that it came from that, like that first time I saw a distillery in action. You're like,
can read about things, you can watch YouTube videos, but like being there and having that like total sensory, you know, feel for the place is pretty impactful.
You know, you said walking in and kind of getting the aromas and all that, and I have actually yet to visit a sake brewery, but I understand what you're saying, you know, from walking into like shochu distilleries and stuff, and you're like, oh, okay, this is not a reference point that I previously had, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, this smells amazing in here. You know, it's fascinating that you really decided to like make this jump from pharma and this extremely professional career that you had dialed in and turning your at-home hobby from, you know, brewing and playing around into something professional. That's a big jump. We're about the same age, and you know, to make that jump, and what year did you decide to do that? For what insanity, what, you know, made you?
Yeah, no, I mean, the whole thing was like terrifying for both Brian and I. I mean, Brian also left, you know, a successful previous career that he had. And just, as you know, starting a small business is terrifying. So it was sort of like, you know, Brian and I met in Japan and we became friends, and so we talked frequently. And it was a kind of a fantasy thing, like, hey, what if we did this? What if like how we do this? Sure. And it just snuck up on us and became more real, you know. Like that's like, you know, the next thing we knew is, okay, I guess I'll quit my job today. You know,
yeah.
Like I guess we're doing this.
It does sneak up on you and happen like that. But you are, because you're specializing in what is, you know, traditionally considered a Japanese beverage, I can only assume there are much more hurdles for you to like kind of learn the craft. There, it's, you know, if you're a beer brewer, you can go to any number of hundreds of breweries on the next block and say, hey, can I work here with you? I can think of like a handful of sake breweries in the U.S. Some of them really, you know, not executing at the same level. And there's also, you know, the whole competition aspect of it. When you decided to dive in and do that, what was the roadmap? Did you have a roadmap? Were you just kind of flying by the seat of your pants? Did you go to Japan?
Yeah, it was more of the latter. So I'm mostly self-taught. I've done a few internships in Japan. But really, like, you know, we had to kind of make it all up. We had to build a lot of our equipment. We still build a lot of our equipment. We just gone through expansion where we actually had the funds to buy things directly from Japan. But it is expensive, yeah. And it's even difficult. It's very difficult to find anything used. So we just you know, made things up and tried it out and got lucky, got unlucky sometimes, and just grew from that. You know, like one thing is sake in Japan has been on the decline for decades.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, the cool kids think it's their grandpa's drink, and they're drinking IPAs and Japanese whiskey, you know. So when the other Japanese sake breweries like heard these guys in Brooklyn were making sake, they were very excited about that.
So
one really great thing we had was just like immense support from Japan. Like
That's
everybody
amazing.
Was just very opening to show us everything. And if, you know, if a Japanese brewer is going to come to the United States, they're likely to come to New York. And if they're sure. coming to New York, they're going to come and visit us.
Sure.
So something that might have taken me years to go and visit all these breweries and develop a relationship. Like I've had the luck of being in New York, of having those people come through and just, you know, I tell them, it's a small brewery. It's going to be a quick tour, but I'm mostly going to be asking you questions.
Sure.
So I've just had this kind of like, you know, like the luck of having all these fantastic brewers come through and talk to me.
Was so that a strategic decision by locating yourselves in New York, or was that just kind of icing on the cake that you hadn't really thought about prior?
Yeah, that was icing on the cake. But I mean, New York City is the largest sake consumption, you know, spot in the United States. So
yeah,
that's kind of really what drove that decision.
Yeah. Cause that's a move from coast to coast.
Yeah,
for sure. So, yeah. I mean, what kind of barriers did you find for yourself as kind of a burgeoning, you know, sake brewer, that didn't have a whole lot of experience, you know, moving into this? Did you find any troubles, you know, with whatever, you know, financing or breaking through to, you know, dial in those recipes? You know, it's, if I'm just thinking about if it were me and I had to start, and I know the basics of what you do, but I don't know how it's done. Like, I don't even know where I would start.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. Like, so we actually, so Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company started in Brooklyn many years ago. I think they made citric acid for Coca-Cola. That was their first product. But they have a very old building in Brooklyn that they left, and it turned into an incubator. So there's all sorts of like restaurants and different beverages. So we were lucky to get in there and have some time while Brian was still fundraising. I had time to sit in a small space and kind of examine what was available in the United States, you know, like what our rice was. You know, one thing that we decided early on is that Brian and I are not Japanese. We're not trying to pretend that we're making authentic Japanese sake. We wanted to have sake do what beer and wine has done, you know, and whiskey too. You know, these are beverages that started in other places in the world. And, you know, I think maybe especially wine and beer, you know, 30 years ago, like what beer could you get? You know, sure. Like look at the landscape now. And it's because people started making it locally and they started to like own it. You know, I think America sometimes we take things from other cultures and we really mess it up. But occasionally you get like an American IPA that you can get anywhere in the world now.
Right.
So we felt strongly that we needed to make, you know, be Americans, make American sake. So we use American grown rice. We use Brooklyn water, you know, which my new saying is New York City water is good for bagels, pizza, and sake. And we've had to make up some of our own equipment, you know, see it and like find, I found a really great steel maker here in Brooklyn. So we kind of had to cobble it together, but if you come into our tap room, it looks like a beer brewery tap room or a wine bar. And we're trying to make things as familiar as possible. Because buying a bottle of sake can be complicated for the average American consumer. There's a lot of foreign language. A lot of it doesn't get translated. And it's like, I'll pick a nice picture, you know, on the bottle label.
Yeah, so you get these kind of fantastical names in the translations a lot of times. Absolutely. And if you're, you know, buying it off the shelf, the Japanese can get quite confusing. You were talking about kind of opening up and there not being a lot of other of these breweries around. Is there like a global sake producer community? Obviously, I think that would be heavily concentrated in Japan, but you can't be the only ones doing this. I mean, of course, not in the United States, but in other countries, are we starting to see sake production opening up elsewhere as well?
Yeah, for sure. I think pandemic kind of hampered it a little bit, but it's coming back.
Yeah.
But there's approximately 20 or so small sake breweries in the United States. With our expansion, we're probably the biggest of the small guys now. And then there's sake breweries. We do kind of know each other and we talk frequently. There's sake breweries. There's a sake brewery in Switzerland, in Portugal, where else in Mexico, in Canada. So, you know, people are discovering it and discovering the, you know, how interesting the making of the product is globally.
Right. And that's the part that's been the most exciting for me, to be able to taste sakes from all of these different places, because like you talked about American IPAs, but yes, there's different water, different products that you're working with. There's a different atmosphere, you know, when you're talking about microbes and all these things that can go into it. And we could be 50 years from now, people being like, right now I'm really into Swiss sake. we don't know, because again, like you talked about the craft beer scene blowing up. But I mean, even wine, 50 years ago, American wine was a joke. Or at least it was perceived to be a joke. I mean, while people were working hard doing it, we didn't get very much attention. One of the other ingredients I think that's really important to talk about in this kind of mix of the making something distinctly American or Swiss or Portuguese would be the rice, right? I mean, that's a huge component of sake. So maybe we ought to like rewind a little bit and just kind of give our listeners an overview of what sake is, because I think people get really intimidated by sake because of the, like, you know, kanji on the bottles and all that and the translation.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess if we kind of break it down, what is sake?
So in the style of sake that we make, which is junmai sake, junmai means pure rice. We have four ingredients. We have our water. We have steamed rice. About 20% of that steamed rice we convert to kome koji, or we grow this mold called koji on the rice. And then yeast. So those are the four ingredients that we combine. And I'm just going to segue into koji.
I think it's a good time to do it, because when you say, you know, this kind of mold, what role does the koji play in that?
So that's how we get our sugar, right? So if you're going to, if film beer, you got to mash the grains first to make the sugar, and then you ferment it. In wine, you know, fortunately, the sugar is already in the grape. Mm-hmm. But we kind of heavily mill the rice for sake. So we've got no germ. We can't sprout it like a barley grain. Through whatever fascinating process, like thousands of years ago, humans figured out that this mold that was naturally in part of rice fields, you could propagate that onto rice. And as it grows through the rice, it produces protease and amylase. It breaks up the proteins. It breaks up the starches and sugars. So that's how sake is very, very unique in its fermentation, is that we mash and ferment at the same time. That process is called multiple parallel fermentation. And it's like a second variable. So if you're going to ferment out a beer or whiskey mash or wine, you basically watch the gravity drop. This is like that annoying high school algebra problem where you're filling a pool while it's leaking. There's like two variables. So we're putting sugar into the system the entire time, and our fermentation takes 30 days. So it's really important to start. Yeah, it starts. You need to start off on day one, knowing that in day 30, you want to achieve a certain ABV and still maintain a certain sweetness.
Right.
So it gets very complicated.
Yeah, it's definitely that kind of oddball variable that it also adds to that, you know, that terroir that I was talking about before when we talk about, you know, that sense of place. We talk about it all the time on the show, but like not just being the actual soil or anything where the rice is grown, but your house flavor, right? And a lot of these I knew I was going to call it distillery. Yeah, a lot of these, I mean, these breweries in Japan, you know, some of these have been in business for hundreds of years and they have kind of their house koji. They protect it, you know, and even some distilleries are in this same boat, like in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. You know, you find these rum distilleries that are protecting the black mold on the roof because it helps with that house style. You know, so like after you guys spend some time doing this in at Brooklyn Kura, you should realistically probably come out with a house koji. Does that make sense?
Well, it's less of it koji or Aspergillus oryzae, just because wild Aspergillus can sometimes be bad molds that have toxins in them. So that is the one thing that we do source from Japan. So there is like sort of these laboratory almost producers that produce our spores. It's called kojikin. Is what it is. It's the stuff that we sprinkle on to the rice.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, it could be possible to like propagate that yourself and not buy it every time, but you'd have to like really kind of do some testing to make sure you haven't floated it into some kind of weird way. But the yeast part, and it's, we're open fermentation too. So the koji infuses that 20% of the rice with these enzymes, right? But we go into a tank. We do this process called sandan jikomi, which means the three additions, because we don't have like antimicrobial hops, or we're not boiling our wort.
Right.
We don't have sulfides like wine. So how do we protect our yeast from competing microbes? And the answer is we do, but there are other competing microbes. There's other bacteria. It's open fermentation. So the way we do that is we do three additions. To not overwhelm yeast, we do a first addition where we put a little bit of koji, some steamed rice, some water. We add a little bit of lactic acid, unless it's these different styles of sake called Kimoto and Yamahai, mm-hmm. where we use lactofermentation to achieve that lactic acid. And then we wait a day, let the yeast population grow up, and then we double the size of the batch, and then we double the size of the batch again the following day. Right. And that's a way not to overwhelm the yeast. And another interesting thing about the fermentation of sake is it has one of the highest like cell counts of yeast of any kind of beverage. And it's just really the yeast is just kind of taking care of itself. It's like the boss, you know. So that's another thing we want to like monitor throughout the fermentation.
Yeah, so obviously the koji plays a huge role in this. And the other one of those other components, well, we already talked about the Brooklyn water, but the rice. And you know, I've long wondered why we don't grow more rice in the U.S. We have so much land. It's an extremely sustainable crop. And I mean, I eat rice for every meal. So, or with every meal. So yeah, I'm always kind of wonder, it would definitely help to feed the population, bring things down, but we don't mm-hmm. grow it everywhere. Most of yeah. the rice that we see in the U.S. is coming from California. Now, is the rice that you are using coming in from Japan as well, like your koji, or is that coming from domestic producers?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we leaned into the U.S. So, like you're saying, like if you take Shinkansen or the bullet train in Japan, yeah. if you're not in a city, all you see is tea fields and rice fields everywhere. Yeah. Mm. But you're right. It's like the rice in the United States is largely grown in California and Arkansas.
Arkansas, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so around Little Rock, Arkansas, and the Mississippi's like meandered for millions sure. of years, and there's like these big floodplains down there where it's like very great for growing rice. So there's a lot of rice grown, but there's very very few people that grow sake mai or sake specific rice. Mm. And that rice, what's unique about it is it's a short grain rice, but it forms this thing called a shimpaku. And a shimpaku is sort of, if you look at the grain, there's sort of like a really intense white dot in the center.
Right.
And it's the rice grain storing its starch. So that's a really a great way to make different styles of sake. So there's some sakes that are very rich and umami heavy, like some junmai styles where the rice is milled less. Because at the outside, you've got of the rice grain, you've got more proteins and lipids that's going to lend to a heavier flavor. And then the Japanese way of grading sake is, you know, generally junmai, junmai ginjo, junmai daiginjo, and that has to do with how much you mill the rice. So if you get into like 50% milling, if you've milled away half the rice, you're getting mostly that shimpaku, that starchy center. So. As far as making a sake goes, you're very exposed. Like if you have any flaws in it, because it's going to be such a light, delicate flavor, it's going to be obvious, right? You can cover it up with that, like, you know, a big, heavy tasting sake. You can kind of cover that up. Sure. So back to your question. We leaned into, so we buy our rice from both California and Arkansas. And kind of specifically a few farms. I will shout out Isbell Farms in Arkansas because they are really making an effort to grow sake mai specific. Sort of the king of sake rice is Yamada Nishiki. Okay. And they were the first, as far as I know, the first people in the United States to grow Yamada. And they're growing more sake specific rice because I think they see this is an industry that's growing. So that's great for us. I mean, that gives us more options different rice. It's like, you know, if you look at like a Japanese sake brewing book, like a first third of it is just different rice varieties. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, but here I've got access to maybe three.
Yeah, so, that's what I was going to ask. You know, I mean, right, there's so much. And, you know, I think one of the other things, and you talked about it a moment ago, is like the milling process. And so, I mean, the more you mill off, I always kind of think about it like a dry aged steak, right? You start with the whole piece, by the time you get to the dry age, it's you've cut half of it away, which is of course going to make it a more expensive product, right? Because you're throwing out half of what you started with. And so I, you know, we always hear about the milling and the polishing, but I was thinking about this before we sat down today. So you've got a handful of different producers or kinds of rice that you can get in the United States. As this industry is growing, and I wouldn't say it's exploding yet, but it's certainly taking off in the way that we saw in the very beginning of the craft beer kind of renaissance. Where does that leave the producers with access to rice? Because there's going to be a finite amount of rice available with more and more producers kind of chasing after it. I was thinking about this because I was in that same boat with, I own a Thai restaurant. Mm-hmm. And when we opened, you know, there were very few. And now there's a ton, and we're all scrapping for the same Thai chilies, lime leaves, you know, lemongrass every year. We're just trying to get more and more. People are trying to catch up, but that takes time, and it certainly takes time with rice.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess to put a positive spin on that, I hope that spurs innovation. I hope that encourages more people to grow like sake specific rice. You know, we love our current growers, you know, but I'd like to see that it's true. We've got a very limited supply of sake specific rice. One kind of saving grace, and I was going to say this earlier, but like, I think if you look at the scene, sake brewing scene in the United States right now, I would really kind of call it the Wild West, in that, you know, people are coming in at all different angles. And there's a big spectrum of the kind of sake that's being produced right now. Like, we decided to really kind of, we wanted people, we're in New York. So, you know, as far as like sake education goes, it's higher here than other places. Sure. So we wanted to serve somebody an accurate representation of what sake was or is.
To clarify, you're meaning you're leaning into a very traditional Japanese style of sake. Yeah.
I mean, one of the biggest compliment I can receive from somebody in the industry in Japan is like, this is like Japanese sake. You know, like,
100%. Okay. Yeah. This tastes like a thing we've been doing for 2000 years.
Yeah. Sounds like a thing. Right. All right. Yeah. I don't want to disappoint that many people. but there are people like doing infused sakes and things that like the geographic indication in Japan for sake is Nihonshu. And so these are things that, you know, aside, you know, apart from not being in Japan, would not be considered Nihonshu because they've got extra ingredients.
Right.
But I think it's a good thing that's happening. We're going through this, you know, evolving time. I think that what the American sake is, in so many years is kind of developing right now. And so I guess to kind of tie it back in, you know, I'm hoping that more rice growers see the potential for this, and that we've got a solid base for choice of ingredients.
Yeah, no, it's amazing that there's more growers out there. I didn't know anything about Arkansas, but it does make sense. I don't know sake well enough to recognize Yamada, but I'm going to learn. You know, that's fantastic. And, you know, is there Koji available domestically, or is that part of you kind of leaning into the very traditional Japanese aspect of it? Because I know we used to work with it in cooking and fermenting foods quite a bit at one of my restaurants, but you know, it's a tough ingredient to get, and it's an even tougher sell. It's easier with a beverage because people don't think about it, but
I love that in a recent Netflix series about starting a restaurant, there was mention of Koji, you know, I love to see it in popular media. It is like, I think maybe probably Noma and their cookbook was probably the first place like in the Western world that kind of like made, you know, it was kind of popularized Koji.
Yeah.
But no, there's just a few like the Koji. There's many, let me say this. There's many different kinds of koji. There's many different kinds of koji. So koji is not just used with sake. It's used to make soy sauce, and miso and shochu. And there is more than the different kinds of yeast. There are more different kinds of koji. They're aspergillus species. It's a very huge family. So you can get
koji spores from many countries in Southeast Asia, but sake specific, the yellow koji or the Aspergillus oryzae, is really only grown in a few places in Japan. So, they've suffered along with the decline of the sake industry in Japan. So, there used to be many, but now there's just a few.
You know, you were talking about the kind of geographic indicator of the, I'm sorry, you said Nihonshu?
Nihonshu?
Right. So is that recognized by the U.S. government on like labeling? Is that a protected name here or is it?
I know it's a GI. I don't know like what like the details of like.
Yeah, I threw that out of the left ball. That's or left field because that's you know definitely a deep question. But the reason I wanted to talk about the GI is so what does it entail in Japan? I'm just curious. Like, is it they literally say okay, just like wine, like here's the you know 15 kinds of rice that you can use. Here's the kinds of koji you can use. Here's how long it has to ferment. You know, what's the kind of brief overview?
Yeah.
I have no knowledge of it.
It is pretty strict. It always reminds me of like the German purity laws for beer. Mm. So it's strict. It like says that you only use these ingredients, and that you can only process it certain ways and it restricts right. additives. It's very like, I like it because it really does kind of protect the history of sake in Japan.
Right.
But I'm glad I don't have to work under it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of red tape in Japan with regulations and kind of the way things are done and, you know, traditional methods. So it's just fascinating. It's something I haven't really dove into that much now. Having said that, why you said you don't have to adhere to that. Does that give you, is it more, I don't know how to phrase this.
It's freeing.
It's freeing, but sometimes you can open too many doors, right? Like it's easier to kind of focus in on what you're doing when you know more or less where the lines are.
Yeah. Like, I guess I was, like I was saying about the spectrum in the United States is there are certainly producers out there that don't care about those rules right. at all and are just going for it. Which is also brings up the idea that you know, we have a Sake Brewers of America Association that one of their missions is to help us legally because it's very complicated for sake. So federally we're considered a beer. But in the state of New York, we're considered a winery, which leads to all sorts of weird conflicts.
Think about that. And you know, the one big difference, you know, between the beer and what you're doing is I wanted to circle back to it. You were talking about the 30-day fermentations. Tell me about that. Why is that such a slow fermentation? Because I think, you know, beer people that are familiar with beer brewing would know that happens usually pretty quickly. And we do talk about on the show quite a bit, like, you know, starting with the wash in the rum world, which, you know, in Jamaica, they do very, very long ferments, but that's specifically to get a very heavy, high ester, high congener style, of rum, but that's running through a still. So you're talking about coming right out of the tank. So, I mean, what is that 30 days? What's the idea there?
Yeah, there's a little bit of wiggle room, for the duration of fermentation and the temperature, but really that came out of just how humans put together making sake. Like it was a thing that that people did in Japan in the winter when they couldn't fish or farm, right? So they were faced with a very cold environment. They selected a yeast. So we use Saccharomyces cerevisiae. That yeast has three different branches. It's got a beer, a wine, and a little known sake branch. Hmm. So they selected a yeast that could work at very cold temperatures. That's going to extend the fermentation time a little bit. I mean, that yeast is, of those yeasts are very powerful. I can come in, so I work in metric. So I'll start a batch at like 5 degrees Celsius, which is pretty close to freezing. And I'll come in the next day and the whole batch is just turning over. You know, it's just vigorously fermenting at 5 degrees, which is impressive for a yeast.
Wow.
And the other things is like I was saying earlier, we have that multiple parallel fermentation. So,
right.
So you know, like you would like blow a beer brewer's mind if you told them you can mash at 5 degrees C, but we do. We're essentially doing a very slow mash the entire time we're fermenting, and we keep it cold. So like a Daiginjo, we will start off at 5 degrees C, and then we won't go above like 10 or 11 degrees C. And so that's very cold. It's like a gentle warming curve, and we're balancing, you know, the sugar that the amylase is putting out,
right,
with the fermentation power of the yeast. And it also is stressful. You know, I think too, with our Brooklyn water, we don't have a lot of minerals in it. Mm. So I think, that stress is also causing some of the ginjo ka or the esters and things that you smell on sake. Sake's got, you know, real specific, like esters that are involved with it.
Yeah.
Ethyl caprosan.
And is ethyl caprosan? What do we associate that with?
That one's always a very difficult smell for me to describe. Like it's somewhere between strawberry, lychee, cantaloupe. One of the big aromas in sake. And then isoamyl acetate, which is a very banana smell. These are kind of the two big players in sake aroma.
I'm glad you went there because that was one of my questions that I wanted to ask you today was, you know, what are the kind of aromas that we associate with sake? Because, you know, we hear the like wine terminologies and beer terminologies and, you know, piney or citrusy, whatever wine, you know, blackberry or minerally. What are we looking out for when we're tasting a sake, especially if, you know, we're not well versed in this beverage? You know, what should people be looking out for when they're like put their nose into the glass that first time?
Yeah, it's, I'll say for beginner, it's difficult. It's nuanced. Yes. I feel like sake has, you know, some of the aromas and tastes, like the same breadth of aromas and tastes that like beer does. The beer is like, beer, wine, and whiskey can be more obvious. Like beer has got malt and hops, and those are just like bang
in your face.
But sake, it's got all that nuance is just compressed into a small space. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we do is we serve sake in a wine glass, and because it's a lot of what we do is education. Because you know, some of the misconceptions about sake. People think it's distilled. And I think part of that is it's a clear liquid. It's typically traditionally served in a small vessel.
Yes.
And the reason for that is just in Japanese culture, that's a way for the host to, you know, pay attention to the guests. Right. Like, oh, your glass is empty. I can pour your glass. And it's just a friendly thing. And so I think like Westerners have associated that with like a shot of vodka that they'll drink quickly. So we put it absolutely in a wine glass. Yeah. We treat it like, you know, swirl the glass, you know, take some time, and appreciate all that. But yeah, like it's the aroma, kind of varies with that, like that kind of grading system I was saying, whether it's Jumai Ginjo, Jumai Daiginjo. Jumai Daiginjo, where 50% of the rice grain has been milled away, is usually fermented very, very cold, typically with like modern yeast, which kind of pop that aroma a little bit better.
Okay.
And that's supposed to be like, Daiginjo has been described as like delicious water. You know, it's like that's, if you're going to go out drinking,
see that. Yeah,
and you're going to spend that. The money on Daiginjo, which can be expensive, like you can run into trouble because it's like, it's delicious water. You know, all night long.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas Junmai might be like, you know, they might leave a lot of that like outer part of the rice on, and it might be kind of heavy. There's even like aging is not a huge deal in sake, but some of the Junmais kind of like do well with a little bit of aging, and it just brings out like this richness Like even eventually, like it darkens a sake. It can end up even like really old sake, like that's potentially aged, can look like soy sauce almost and be like really rich.
Yeah, I had an incredible opportunity when I was in Tokyo. My wife and I ate at Narisawa and did like a, I don't know, 12 courses, whatever it was. I'm a sucker for fine dining every now and again, but every course was paired with sake, except for, I believe, one that had a Japanese Chardonnay, which was gorgeous. But it was really eye-opening because it works so well with many different kinds of food. It's more flexible, and even with this wide variety of different styles and sake, you know, and different grading, like you were talking about, it worked so well with so many different courses, even like the heavy meat courses. And I think something in your head says, well, that's going to be too light to go with a, you know, a Kobe beef course, you know, where it's going to be fat and meat, and it absolutely does not get blown out of the water. What are your kind of the favorite kinds of food that would you recommend people kind of check out and play around with, you know, with pairing? I know not everybody wants to pair, but it's fun. You really can open up a lot of the flavors of sake by putting the right food with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, you know, I'm lucky to be in New York City where like we really have incredible food scene. And so we've definitely made an effort to like, you know, pairing with, there's a ton of izakayas and different and sushi places and different Japanese restaurants in New York.
Yeah.
And that's an easy pairing with it. But we've really made an effort to like reach out to different foods and get people on board with like, you know, there's pizza places that have us, there's steakhouses that pour our sake. And like, you know, I think that richness really kind of pairs with it well. And that challenges me to like, you know, make sakes that will go with these foods that people are interested in serving us with.
Yeah, it's certainly a mountain that you have to climb at this point, you know, since there are so few sake breweries in the United States, and it's not so much ingrained in our culture as it is in Japan. And it's almost like to be the brewer, you also have to be an educator, as you talked about doing that at Brooklyn Kura. You know, where do you move from here? Where does Brooklyn Kura go from here? Because I know you just did a huge expansion. And I presume it's going to take a little while before you even kind of wrap your head around what that means for Brooklyn Kura. Any plans?
Yeah. So right now for me as the master brewer here, it's kind of like learning our new facility.
Yeah.
You know, getting our equipment up. I know more about New York City boiler law than I ever thought I would know about. It's just like, you know, some of that usually start floating away from like the day-to-day making. You have to deal with these other things, but I want to get back into the making, you know, like we're almost, you know, fully up and running. And you know, the education part is a really big part. So we now have this great friend of ours, Timothy Sullivan, who's a sake samurai. And he's running our sake study center.
Amazing.
So when our tap room's not open, it's a classroom. And we can bring in, you know, the general public, you know, who wants to taste sake, who wants to pair with cheese, you know, different kinds of food events. And then we can bring in the staff of a restaurant and walk them through sake education course, and even professional sake sommeliers. We have a way to certify those folks, and I think that's really important for the industry outside of Japan.
Yes,
because we're growing, but there's an education aspect that has to grow with us.
Absolutely, it's a beautiful thing that you're able to do those things. It just like clicked when you were talking about, you know, pairing sake with cheese. It's like, you know, you have this kind of really beautiful tradition of making sake in a Japanese style at the same time, putting it with food that did not come up with the beverage. And so now that we have kind of globalization and we have access to all of these things, you can in New York, you have all of it. You can just sit down and here's some cheese and here's this. Because I think it's easy to just be like, oh, of course, I'm going to have it with sushi or when I go to the izakaya. But, you know, thinking about doing it with a cheese platter is it's a really fun time. Yeah. I'm getting excited about it for you and I'm not even involved in the sake industry. Where can people find Brooklyn Kura physically? Where can people visit you? And an online presence. Where can they find you online?
Yeah, so we're brooklynkura.com. We have a thing called Kojikin, or Kurikin, I'm sorry.
I'll just sign up for both.
You can tell I'm the maker and I don't deal with it. But we have a subscription service. That's up to how American, you know, prohibition liquor laws are state to state. So
I'm in Indiana. So, you don't have to tell me.
Yeah. So we're working on that part now to get it more broadly distributed. With our expansion, we're making like we're focusing more on like sort of shelf stable product. Like we've done a lot of Nama Nama or unpasteurized sake, which like travels great to our local area. But now we want to get stuff out further to people. So that's like the learning curve we're on right now and working with all the new equipment. If you come to Brooklyn, you can visit our tap room. You can sign up for tours. And of course, the Sake Study Center, there's some remote classes as well. You can sign up for those.
This is amazing because it's exactly what's needed to kind of grow this segment of the industry out. Online is Brooklyn Kura got an online presence?
BrooklynKura.com at Brooklyn Kura.
I thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this today. It's definitely a much longer conversation than we have time for. But when we have time for a 7-hour episode, we absolutely. But no, I would absolutely love to have you back on the show because this is a topic that I very much enjoy. And we just don't have enough people out there to discuss Japanese beverages, sake, shochu especially. There's like two you can get in the whole damn country.
Yeah.
First time I walked into a bar in Singapore that had like a wall of shochu, I was like, oh my god.
No, you've been doing a great job with your guests and who you're covering. I think
it's easy. Just talk to people that are doing the things that I'm interested in and hope that everybody else is interested too. Brandon, again, thank you so much, man. I absolutely can't wait to talk to you again. I'm going to be in New York here this summer. Definitely going to swing by.
Oh, please come by.
Until next time, come by.